Thanks for listening to this Word in Your Ear podcast. If you'd like to get early access to all our productions ad-free, priority booking for our live events, and to take part in our weekly quiz, go to patreon.com/wordinyourear for more details.
You're listening to a podcast from The Word.
Oh, we're back. We're back in full effect.
We're back and we're wearing the merchandise.
We're wearing the matching merch.
Matching merch.
All three of us here. So this is rather exciting, actually. We're going to try a kind of three-cornered stack waddy game. It's a triathlon, is it? Yeah, maybe. Okay, because the thing about a stat waddy game is you've got to have an idea of who you're going to play it with. You can't just play it to everybody, can you? Because it depends on the level of familiarity and expertise of the individual you're playing.
If they know absolutely nothing about the subject, you've got a kind of green field opportunity.
Yes.
I think I've chosen one that, but I think neither of you would be particularly queued up.
Do you want to go first?
I could try if you want.
Go first.
My idea was that European dance clubs tend to have, you know, funky, sparkling, organic, faintly new age names, as do the wide range of products offered by Gwyneth Paltrow's modern lifestyle brand.
Oh, Goop.
Okay.
So is this a Belgian nightclub or something you put on the end of your penis?
Yes, or an aromatic candle. That's right. It's curiously fragrant accessory. Is it Rave Palace or Gwyneth Paltrow lifestyle purchase? Dance venue or wallet-draining cosmetic and cuisine accessory from the star of Shakespeare in Love? Okay. I don't know. Okay, here's the first one. Barmyard. Which is that? Barmyard.
Wait, how are we spelling that?
B-A-L-M-Y-A-R-D.
That's a cosmetic product, surely. I can't imagine going to a club that had balm in the title. That would be
balmy. I don't know. I think it's very new age, actually.
No, it's a chill out zone, isn't
chill
it?
Chill out zone. 8 hours set from...
It's a Sunday morning kind of recovery thing, isn't it?
Suddenly recovery, yeah. 8 hour set from flute playing Banco de Gaia. No, Barmyard is a romantic cool body oil for $82 from Gwyneth.
Oh, no. Very good.
All right, okay. Carry on. Okay, next. Sweet Earth. Sweet Earth.
It's a club. It's a club.
It's Goop's plant-based bacon flavoured with hickory, sage and garlic.
Bacon.
Yes, you're good. We're not shy with the saucy marinade situation. It's smoky, sweet, and a little tangy with legit BBQ values. So there we are. That's good, isn't it? All right, Eden.
Eden. Go on, you go, Alex.
I'd imagine that's a club.
It is. It's a Mancunian botanical paradise and dance venue reminiscent of Studio 54. But then you can't tell, can you? Manta.
Dance venue.
No, it's a flexible palm-sized brush which has bendy, forgiving bristles that minimise snags and also feels massage-like on the scalp. $30. What a load of absolute bollocks, honestly. Papaya. Okay. Is that Goop or is it glow stick?
Goop, surely.
I'm going to go glow stick.
No, glow stick is glow stick. No, it's an industrial-scale Croatian nightclub that accommodates 3,500 revelers. Two or three more. Here we come. Padova. Is that a nightclub?
Nightclub.
It's a ceramic non-stick 10-piece cookware set from the Paltrow range. $229. Ouch. Fluxus. Okay, Fluxus.
Fluxus. This is a group.
Hell, look at a bath oil coming off that. Surely.
He's trying to lead you astray. It's a club.
It's a converted shoe factory in Lithuania, accommodating 10,000 people, art installations, navy projectors. It feels like a squat party. God damn, people just want to be there. You love
it. That sounds attractive, doesn't it?
It really does. I know. Okay, come on, three to go. Dua Nova. Club or product?
Go on, Dave.
Club.
It's Great. It's Paltrow's electric cooking pot. Use it to pressure cook, saute, and steam. Here you go, Lux.
Well, that used to be soap, didn't it, back in the
60s? Yeah, it did, back in the day.
If it's soap in the 60s, it's probably a club now, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. Very good deduction. All major DJs from Europe play in Lux, widely regarded as Lisbon's top club, and with good reason, says here. Okay. The last one is Kaiku. Kaiku.
Over to you, Alex.
I'm going to go for Goop.
You know, it's an underground techno house venue at the heart of Helsinki's nightlife. So there you go. But it's tricky, wasn't it? It's tricky. You can't
Very
tell.
Good.
Go on, you guys, far ahead. Have you got one for Alex? You have done.
I'm gonna try Alex on this, which is basically in the late 60s, post Sergeant Pepper, pretty much every group which fancied itself in any way kind of slightly trippy and psychedelic would include amongst their repertoire of new songs a certain number which were kind of like children's songs. They were like Toy Town songs, okay? This is inspired by like Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds and things of that nature. So everybody that did this. And so you now have to tell me whether these are examples of psychedelic Toy Town pop or genuine children's stories. Okay, Alex?
Okay.
You got the idea? Okay, so... Sir Geoffrey Saved the World. Sir Geoffrey Saved the World. Is that a children's story about a brave knight, or is it a tune by the Bee Gees?
Oh my God. I'm going to say that's a children's story.
No, it's a tune by the Bee Gees.
What?
Every day is Saturday, feeling unsteadily, laughing at people with stars in their eyes. Vicar Hayes approaching town, preaching in the underground. Talking with the lambs who came out of the sky. Wow. You know how Sir Geoffrey saved the world. Comes from the Bee Gees album Horizontal. Okay.
Brilliant.
It's a long road from there to staying alive, isn't it? My God.
It is.
Okay, here we go. Moving on. The Jolly Postman. The Jolly Postman. Is that a children's story? Or is that an album track by Dave D, Dozy, Beak and Megan Titch? The Jolly Postman.
I'm erring towards album track by Dave D, Dozy, Beaky, Mission Titch, actually.
No, it's by Janet and Alan Alberg. Once Upon a Bicycle, So They Say, The Jolly Postman Came One Day. Very well-known children's book, actually. Mark and I probably both read it to our children.
We did. But it's funny how the world has instantly improved just by saying the words Dave D, Dozy, Beaky, Mick and Titch.
Absolutely.
Suddenly it's a better place. It is.
Absolutely. Okay, the next one. The next one. Here we go. Gentleman Joe's Sidewalk Cafe. Is that a much-loved American children's book? Or is it a tune by Status Quo?
That's a Quo tune, surely.
It is. It is. It Good is. Work. During the sort of Pictures of Matchstick Men, you know, period, they did that kind of thing. I'm gonna give you two more. Okay. Come and buy my toys. Come and buy my toys. Is that the much loved children's story about the door-to-door seller of toys to small children in an industrial town in the kind of L.S. Lowry Manchester of everybody's imagination? Or is it a track by David Bowie?
With a title, you could probably might have trouble getting away with now, wouldn't you, in this weirdly sensitive world? Yeah.
I'm going to... Okay, it's a Bowie track.
It is. Smiling girls and rosy boys, come and buy my little toys. Monkeys made of gingerbread and sugar horses painted red. Okay. And one more. Pegasus the Flying Horse. Is that a much-loved children's book, particularly aimed at the equine sensitivities of young girls, or is it a tune by the Hollies?
I'm going to say that's a children's book.
No, it's a tune by the Hollies. Follow me, follow, see what you see. I'll take somewhere where you've never been, high in a mountain, deep down in the sea, to faraway lands you can travel with me. I'm Pegasus the Flying Horse. song written by Tony Hicks, The Hollies. So I think, fantastic. You know, honors
that was
quite
really,
even.
Really, really good.
Brilliant.
That okay, over to you, Alex. Who are you?
Alex, have you got one that both of us might be in the market for then?
Yeah, this is for both of you. I'm go still a Stack Waddy novice, of course. So I'm going with the old formula where I'm setting out a number of things and in which there is one ringer.
So five things and one ringer. Yeah, go on.
Okay.
These are DJ names. There are four genuine DJ names, and there is one that I've made up because it's fun.
Okay.
And these are Chinese Man. Roy of the Ravers.
That's a great name.
Spinston Churchill.
That's brilliant.
Pants and Socks.
Pants and Socks.
And God. DJ Twat.
DJ Twat. Oh my Lord. I'm going to chip in straight away and say that don't say anything at the moment, but I think Spinston Churchill must be real. There are a ton of names like that, you know, aren't there? The kind of grime minister type names where people just kind of just, you know, put in these torturous puns. And it's also a very funny name. Roy of the Ravers, I think, is real too. Don't you, Dave? I don't know, because it's got that kind of cartoon capery kind of tang to it. I don't know.
Okay, go on.
DJ Twat, I'm sure, is real because...
Basically,
absolutely everything that you imagine could be a DJ's name sort of is. Chinese Man doesn't seem exciting enough to be one thing. Although, I don't know, gosh. But then that leaves us with Pants and Socks, doesn't it?
It can't be made up.
Can't Pants and Socks. So maybe it's Roy of the Ravers. I think. What do you think, Dave?
Go on, all right.
You've made up Roy of the Ravers.
Do you want to hazard a guess, Dave, or do you want to go with
Roy? I would say DJ Twat, but anyway.
Okay. Well, the ringer is Spinston Churchill.
No, because that's the best by some margin.
But I would like
Why to has that never been claimed?
Well, I would like to tell you that Oprah Spinfrey and Osama Spin Laden are real DJ names. So it has been utilised.
They're very good. Very good. Well, you win. Deservedly so. Spinston Churchill. You'd go and see Spinston Churchill, wouldn't you, in a flash? Terrific.
A Chinese.
Oh, well.
We shall entertain them on the beaches. Yeah.
Oh, Lord. Very good. Very good. Well, if people have got further ideas for other Stack Waddy games, what's the address, Alex?
It is wiye.london@gmail.com.
@gmail.com. So we've all been listening to it's not the Bruce Springsteen podcast, is it? It's the Barack Obama podcast. I think that's where it started, isn't it? Interesting point. Yeah, I wrote a thing about this week, actually, because I think it started, I got the impression it started life as Barack Obama that does a deal with Spotify to do a podcast and then has to think who he's going to do it with. So he obviously can't have kind of a standard TV host or whatever. And so he thinks, who's a similar legend to me? I know. I got my mate Bruce Springsteen.
My old pal Bruce Springsteen. Yeah.
And so it's supposed to be Obama's thing, I think, mainly.
It is.
You know,
he's meant to be the host. Absolutely. Yeah.
But it is quite interesting. One of the things that struck me listening to it is that the person who most naturally goes into the role of the chairman is the former leader of the free world. Because what politicians are used to doing is getting people to tell them things. Yeah. Whereas rock stars are not used to doing that at all. Rock stars are used to being entirely on the other side of that that exchange. You know what I mean? They tell you what they think.
Yeah.
Whereas politician goes, and have you come far? And what do you think about so-and-so? You know what I mean?
It's that interviewer-interviewee paradigm, isn't it?
I found that really interesting. You know, these two immensely kind of, well, just beyond famous people, aren't they? You know, used to having their every utterance being poured over by people in a room together.
Did you find yourself as I did, I think, very slightly disappointed after a while, because the only problem is it feels like a kind of brand alliance. And the novelty of hearing the two of them together, which is really, really thrilling, actually, at first, I thought wore off quite quickly. And it struck me that the way podcasts normally work is you've got people with slightly opposed views. It's that friction and it's that difference that makes for an interesting perspective. You know, and actually, interestingly enough, they have 12 years between them, but Obama's 12 years younger, but they didn't exploit that at all. And what you've actually got is two guys mostly agreeing with each other because they're really rather in awe of each other. And they say so. I mean, you know, Springsteen's got that kind of consummate cool, which Obama refers to, the cowboy hats, the guitars, the motorcycles, the command of giant rock and roll audience. And Obama's got that profoundly enviable poise, knowledge and intellectual authority. And I didn't think, I thought what it needed was various things, but I didn't need a bit of friction, because you never get a debate going, really. You know, it's just the two of them talking about big issues and largely just agreeing. And what I felt that would be wonderful, but it's impossible, obviously, in that format, is that it's the little issues that are actually really interesting. You know, I'd love to have heard them talking about popular culture, or, you know, is the Queen's Gambit any good? Or should Frasier be coming back? Was the Britney documentary really good? But they can't do that because people immediately quote everything they say. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, they're not gonna,
so
they're
I not wondered, I well. My only feeling was there enough maneuverability within that format to carry on producing really interesting stuff? Or they, I mean, stuff about the fathers was interesting. That was interesting, wasn't it?
Yeah. It's interesting that Springsteen's father has, you know, if you've been going to Springsteen shows as long as I have, Springsteen's father has gone from being this person referred to as a difficult man to now he was mentally ill.
You know,
that's what he's come to terms with, you know.
Yeah.
And Springsteen's obviously had therapy in that time, you know, and so that all comes out in those kind of conversations, doesn't it?
Yeah, and Obama, I can't remember the story.
Obama can't do that at all.
No, and Obama's dad deserted him, I think, when he was 2, didn't he? Is that right? Came back when he was about 8 or 10 or something.
Yeah,
he was
so
expected to have a kind of relationship with him, and he was going, this is impossible. Yeah. You know? I thought that was really moving, actually. They were talking about growing up with a lack of father figures in their lives, which is why both of them were so incredibly driven, because they were in charge from a very early stage, weren't they? So I thought that was good. But I don't know whether or not it's got legs. I'm not sure.
Go on, Alice.
You kind of expect Obama and Springsteen to be talking about, you know, hashtag big things that are, you know, sort of directly applicable to American life. And so there wasn't really any surprises in there, I felt, as eloquent as it was. But also, I realised that I'd never heard Springsteen speak before, and his voice was a little bit higher than I expected it to be, and I found myself just drifting.
You never heard Bruce Springsteen speak?
He must have done. You must have seen live
tours forever.
I've just listened to the records.
You can't shut him up.
I've never watched the Springsteen live performance. I've watched the version of the Chuck Berry track he did.
You
never can tell. Oh, isn't that great? Oh, my Lord. He teaches the band to play it. It's brilliant.
Oh, astonishing. But he's kind of booming
over. The giveaway in that Springsteen thing was that I fascinated me. I was listening to it thinking, how many people do you think are in the room? I couldn't stop thinking about it. There's somebody pouring coffee at the beginning, and then at one point when he goes into playing a song, he asks for a pick.
Yeah.
And obviously the guitar roadie is there.
Yeah.
Somebody hands it to him. And you think to yourself, well, there's obviously a motorcade outside and secret service men as far as the eye can see.
Helicopters overhead.
That's what obviously happens. There will be managers. There will be people from Spotify. There's probably a room full of people.
Yeah, and people agonising over every syllable as to whether or not they can say it and whether or not they'll have to re-record that bit because they simply can't put it out.
Well, that's another thing.
Their job was to appear fantastically informal and cool and relaxed. And you guys just, you know, just chewing the cud out in a woodshed somewhere, you know. No, I thought that was consummate genius, but I don't know. It was fascinating. It was thrilling to hear them together.
It'd be interesting to see how it develops.
Exactly. Exactly.
The Word Podcast, prime cuts of popular culture served fresh each week.
So we're back in 1971, 50 years ago this week, this record came out. Nick Drake's Brighter Later 50 years ago. And even though, if you look on the label, it says 1970. Interestingly, didn't come out until 1971. Why was it delayed? Do you remember, Mark?
Postal strike?
Postal strike.
Yes, I do.
We remember it well.
It's funny that I remember that so vividly. The postal strike went on for something incredible, like 7 weeks.
It's something like that.
And it mattered so much. Oh,
absolutely. Absolutely extraordinary. And so it was also this week, 50 years ago, the Rolling Stones started what they called their farewell to the UK tour, because they were just about to relocate in the south of France. And so I've got the dates here.
Is it amazing that we put up with that at the time? There they were. They had that flyer with a picture of an old, lovely old charabang with them kind of waving. So long, suckers. We're off to make a fat load of cash, which we made out of you, actually, in the south of France.
Well, I don't think they didn't make much of it out of us, because, listen, these are the dates of the Rolling Stones tour. So they hadn't played in Britain since 1967, apart from Hyde Park, things like that. They toured in America, but not in the UK. So they started on the 4th of March at Newcastle City Hall. How many shows? One. Okay.
Incredible, isn't it?
5th of March, Manchester Free Trade Hall. Saturday, Coventry Theatre. Monday, Glasgow Greens Playhouse. Remember that. On the Tuesday, the Bristol Colston Hall. Then Brighton, the Big Apple. Liverpool Empire, Leeds University. And then the Roundhouse was their one London show.
The Roundhouse, tiny venue. That's 1,700 people. That's ridiculous, isn't it?
And they were absolutely celebrating. They're absolutely at their peak in lots of ways. But the scale of things in Britain was still quite small.
Well, they were at their peak, certainly in that kind of satin finery, weren't they? There were pictures of them at the time which looked like they'd come direct from the Palace of Versailles. Direct from the court of Louis XIV, satin capes, hats. Was it incredible?
Yeah, well, he took to the stage of first night in Newcastle City Hall wearing a kind of satin baseball cap and satin jacket and so forth. And I've got a picture here, which I was just looking at, which you've probably seen, of Mick and Bianca arriving at Newcastle Station. Which is really interesting, because they're playing Newcastle that night. So presumably the gear has just gone ahead.
Yeah.
And the Stones are like, you just turn up when you feel like, kind of thing, you know. And so Mick's come on a train from London with his paramour, dressed up, as you say, like courtiers from their side.
Yeah.
And just going over that bridge in Newcastle Station that we've all no doubt gone over many times to, you know, change platforms there. And then I think they're staying afterwards at somewhere like the Gateshead Post House. So, you know, there's none of that
glamour.
You know, domiciled in a stately home 50 miles away, anything like that. You know, they were only one up from a travelling salesman, really, in terms of the kind of the luxurious life they led.
Yeah.
You know, in those days, if you could stay in a hotel at all, you were quite enviable, weren't you, really? So they were no different from anybody else.
There was that thing in the Watersons, wasn't there, where they were talking about how their tours are structured. And they were saying, we bring sleeping bags because sometimes we won't have a hotel. You know,
they might end up in the van, the Watersons, which we were talking about last week.
And they didn't know. There was no, that planning element just wasn't there at that level.
It's really interesting. I was talking to somebody about this week. I mean, the reason that the Blue Boar on the M6 was the kind of legendary rock and roll hangout in the middle of the night that everybody talked about, wrote songs about, was because everybody always came back from wherever they played outside London. They didn't stay. They got in the van in the middle of the night and drove back down to their homes in London. You know, so staying in a hotel. Loads of bands, when they went to the States, they just weren't used to it. They hadn't done it at all in the UK, you know. Or if they had, they'd pretty much stayed in boarding houses, you know, that level of luxury.
But also, staying in hotels is very expensive, isn't it? Into your minimal profits. I was reading a thing about that tour in 1971, and it's a brilliant exchange with a reporter who says, many remark on the tendency of Mick Jagger to be as feminine as masculine. Would you like to be a woman? Mick Jagger says, if God wants me to be a woman, then a woman I will become. And you think, they really were ahead of the game, weren't they?
Because
that's kind of a very, very kind of topical thing to be saying, really. That's the story 50 years ago. But one thing I remember so vividly about them moving to the south of France, which I think they did, the tax exile movies, I think
in May,
April that year, or April or May, or something, was that the legend always was, you know, Dave, because you've researched this and you've written lots of stuff about it, but the legend was that to get Keith to go, they had to transport, do you remember those stories? They had to transport his sofa from Chelsea with his ashtrays and his lamps with the scarves draped over them and everything as it was, and reconstruct his room in the south of France and pretty much pick him up, take him to the aircraft, fly him there, ship him in horizontally and put him back on the sofa in the south of France. Now, whether or not that's true, I want it to be true.
Yeah, I know you. Well, I want to. Well, to further extend that idea, the reason that the album, because they went there and started making what became Exile on Main Street,
yeah,
and the reason that was made at Nelcott was that was Keith's place. And so the chances of getting Keith to go anywhere else were just nil. And so the rest of the Rolling Stones
were
scattered
all
over the place. And they had to just go there. And you know, they basically, you could get Keith from his bedroom into the basement and then back to the bedroom.
Yeah.
You couldn't do anything further.
You couldn't go any further.
And Mick Taylor, who'd only, you know, only recently joined, didn't he? He, you know, he was staying sort of about 80 miles away or something. They'd all found different
Charlie's
places
saying,
to live.
Miles away.
And he had, Mick Taylor couldn't drive. And so his wife used to have to drive him every day. So his wife every day took if there's one thing more tedious than being a member of the band waiting for Keith to get up to play, it's being the wife of a member of the band who's had to drive him down there.
And then when they get in the car, they've got to wait for another kind of 14 hours before the pajamaed figure stumbles into view, you know. Absolutely.
And he only got out of bed at all because they started playing in the basement. And so they, you know, the noise was pretty. Pretty unavoidable, I would have thought, you know. But it's anyway, the great bit of the Rolling Stones, which is from that pretty much this week or from the following week, they played Leeds University and they recorded a show, which I think was for broadcast on, believe it or not, the Dave Lee Travis show. It was not John Peel, it was
the snooker.
It was lunchtime, it's probably when lots of people are listening,
yeah.
And there is their version of Let It Rock, which they put on the B-side of Brown Sugar. That it comes from there, the live version of Let It Rock, which I still think is the best live Rolling Stones recording ever. It's just that version of Let It Rock, which is just that inimitable way of playing Chuck Berry songs. Not like Chuck Berry played them. They played them in their own way. So, 50 years ago this week. So we're also marking, well, I don't know if it's an anniversary, but you've seen that amazing piece of film of Frank Sinatra in the studio.
Oh, God, I thought that was amazing.
1965.
His mic technique was fantastic. He just instinctively knew how to move his head, you know, to move with the dynamics of his own voice.
Describe it, Alex, what we're seeing, because it's so different from what people's view is of what a recording session is nowadays.
So it's completely it's completely open plan. So these days you'll be recording vocals in a booth that's isolated and completely sonically closed off to the rest of the world. But Frank's there with his cup of Joe on the go.
And still wearing a tie, isn't he? Loosened tie.
Rakishly loosened tie.
We'll come back to that.
But he's got the orchestra in there with him. It's a completely open plan room, and there's stuff that's going on around him, around the mic. So the mic would have been picking up noise from God knows where, I'd have thought. But it's a completely the room's just packed with other activity, and he's just in the middle of it with a rudimentary mic set up.
Because that will have been, I guess, in the studios at Capitol Studios. I think it will. You were probably still recording there, because the recording studios were in the basement of Capitol Studios in Hollywood. And when he recorded, he always wanted an audience. And so they would get the secretaries and so forth from the typing pool, pretty much.
Wow.
Mrs. Sinatra is recording today downstairs. Come downstairs. You all sit there, don't say anything.
Which I think we should explain to you, because when you see this bit of footage, and we must post this actually, there are people in the background who are not playing an instrument or doing anything at all. No, they are.
They're just watching. They're just watching,
and he likes it. But I mean, God, I think it was amazing. And it made you realize just so many disciplines were required, weren't they, that are no longer those skills that you no longer that composure, that ability to collaborate, that ability to do a live take with an orchestra of what, I don't know, 45 people or whatever in one go, and to beforehand to check and modify the arrangements. I thought it was incredible. And he talked about clarity and diction, didn't he, at one point?
He talks about dealing with the pops, doesn't he? Because he's very concerned that they shouldn't have to go back and
take out the pops.
Tribal with it in any way, you know.
Yeah.
So is he the right distance from the mics? Well, because they don't have a pop shield, do they?
Well, that was But that was interesting because that, you know, that he was working on the assumption that what he did would be fine, whereas most musicians, I think, go to the studio, you know, hoping that the engineer can fix any quirks in the tape.
Yeah, and there's a bit at the very end which is just close up of him listening to himself singing back, which is really interesting. All he wants is to check it was as good as he thought it was. He's not. There's no suggestion of self doubt, is there? There's absolute 100% confidence. Two pop facts about Sinatra, Dave. These are true. Two pop facts. Wasn't he one of the very first stars of the microphone era? Am I right?
Yeah. Well, I think they all say Bing Crosby was the first one, I think.
But I think he was pretty much second, maybe slightly earlier. But I think before that, the discipline required in being a singer was that you had to be able to project on stage live in an audience without any kind of amplification. So that whole idea of a kind of music that was intimate, you know, that was somebody whispering in your ear, was possible via that. And the other thing, which I think is true, is that on the 12th of October 1944, he opened his third season at the Paramount Theatre, which I think was a radio broadcast. And a load of girls turned up, 500 girls, with pictures of Sinatra pinned to their dresses in a state of very high excitement. And when he came on stage, they started screaming. And people recognised that as being the first evidence of kind of fan hysteria. Until that point, I know Ouija was there, the photographer, and photographed it and reported on it. And it's generally thought that something had tipped the balance and these women could no longer contain themselves when Sinatra was in the room. And that had never happened to any other singer beforehand. Nobody came out. I was pursued by screaming women. Really interesting.
It's fantastic to watch the clip, though, and to watch the bit, like you say, when he listens back to it.
Oh.
And you realise that it's all there.
Yeah.
At that point, you know, they've done it 5 minutes earlier.
Yeah,
they've rolled the tape back. They've started playing it, and it's there.
It's there.
Nobody really has to do anything with it. You know,
I know.
You don't have to. It doesn't have to be remixed or anything like that. Contrast that. I must show you this. Actually, there's a fantastic interview. If I can find it again, it's on YouTube. With the guy who engineered, you know, you remember late on in his life, he did those duets.
With Bono and people like that.
He did two of them, didn't he?
Yeah.
I think there were two of them. It was like Natalie Cole and Bono was on one.
Yeah, he was.
And obviously, this is the interview with one of the engineers on the session talked about how it was done. And the contrast with the 65 thing could not have been greater. Because the 1965 thing is just utterly authentic. It's him, an orchestra, he sings, it's perfect. The later things were completely pieced together. Absolutely. He never met any of those people. He was never in the studio with any of those people.
Yeah.
Everybody posted in their bits. And also, he technically couldn't do it really anymore. So they were fixing his takes and all kinds of things. It's just so tragic that he did that.
I know.
Late in his life, what was the point of that? You know. But I suppose they want to be in the charts, don't they? You know, when you're in your 70s, your 80s.
Another bit of film which is on YouTube actually, which it really brings across what pressure those people are under in recording studios, is the one of, have you ever seen it, of Cilla Black recording Elfie with the Burt Bacharach Orchestra in London?
Oh no, I haven't seen it.
George Martin's there in the studio too, I think. And George Martin's talked about this. I interviewed him, and he mentioned this to me once, and he said that Bacharach made her do about, oh God knows, 20 takes or whatever, And there she is, this poor little girl. I mean, weeks beforehand, she'd been the coat check girl in the Cavern Club. And there she is with a kind of, again, a 40, 50-piece orchestra around her, and you've got to get it right. You cannot make a mistake. If you make a mistake, or if anybody makes a mistake, they can't use that take. And watching her being made to redo and redo these takes, you think that is a level of discipline that must be absolutely unimaginable. It's incredible.
This is a junction in the Word podcast. It separates that bit from this next bit.
So, festivals, Alex, they're coming back.
Well, allegedly.
Are you excited? Are you excited? What's happening?
Well, I don't see how they're going to be able to do it. I think it's a little bit optimistic. You know, we're still at a stage where we can't go to the pub. With that in mind, the idea
But you can't put 50,000 people in a...
Yeah, naught to 50,000.
It's quite a leap, isn't it?
That way.
Quite a leap.
And actually, I'm more bothered about the pub, aren't you?
Absolutely.
Less
mud, more fun.
But Alex, what I said, just fill me in here. I'm not sure. Glastonbury's not coming back. That's definitely off. Isn't it? I think Reading claimed to be coming back. Is that right?
Reading and Leeds. I think Creamfields. I think they sold out as well. I think they sold something like
that. I think they have. No, Reading. I think it's Stormzy, Catfish, Queens of the Stone Age.
Queens of the Stone Age, they're already planning to buy bands over from America, which is also really badly hit by COVID. Do you know what I mean? The whole thing.
Wouldn't you like to know if this isn't too dull? Wouldn't you like to know the details, the contracts you must make with those people? Because I mean, there must be some kind of cancellation clause.
Oh, there will be.
But then again, if you do cancel it, where else are these people going to go and play? So it can't be too crippling.
That I think was the issue that they're talking about is that you can't get cancellation insurance in this current situation, can
I'm
you?
Sure you can.
That's obviously why Glastonbury was called off so early, because they had to do it before it got too expensive to call it off later.
Right.
There's talk about shouldn't the government step in and ensure that? You think, how the hell can the government ensure these things against cancellation?
There's so many variables. So much liability.
There's so many variables. I don't know. I suppose if it makes people happier to think that they got their tickets and they're confident they get their money back if it's cancelled or whatever,
people have got this to hold on to, and it seems to be really cheering people up. But the practicalities of it are just something else. Reading and Leeds, for example, people go there to mosh, and moshing requires a huge, great wadge of people
physical contact
mulched together.
It does.
It's the polar opposite of social distancing.
Yeah, absolutely.
The one end, social distancing, the mosh. Those are the.
They can't set out deck chairs and plastic screens because it's just not going to work at Reading.
No.
That's true. Yeah. Unless it does, of course.
I'm sure other people are making plans for smaller scale, more socially distanced.
But then everybody's doing that. I sent an email from a mate of mine saying, we booked a weekend in Wales, in the end of June. Probably won't happen, but at least we booked it. It's all that idea about just having things in place, isn't it?
Yeah.
Something to look forward to. It may not come off, but by then we might have thought of something else we might try.
Yeah.
I'd like to go to a pub. I'd love to go to a pub. Would a pub? Oh.
Not just the smell long. Of warm woolly just, ale.
Just, oh. God. Just sit there.
Just that just first, go, that first gulp of that fine ale, and then that kind of silent exhalation where everybody would just be so overloaded with joy that they wouldn't be able to speak.
Absolutely. What would you have if you went in a pub?
Well, I'd probably have a pint of London Pride, which is still my absolute favourite beer.
Yeah, I might go for a pint of Guinness. What about you, Alex?
I'd go
You've been to the pub before lockdown, didn't you?
I last went in November. There's a little village pub up here, and they do a great pint of organic ale, a pale ale called Lawless, which comes in a glass with a handle. So we all know beer tastes better in a glass with a handle.
Oh, right. Yeah, the dimple mug. Yeah.
It's great. But no, I'd probably order the IPA, which had the best cartoon on the label. That's just how I roll. And I know it's not necessarily right, but hey.
That's not a good idea. I don't think you're going to be led by what the labels look like. You're missing out.
Have a pint with a beaver with a gun. That'd be great. Thank you.
All right.
And so it's a small round table in the corner of a pub, and there are three people. There's just us three at it. There's no beer. There were more than three.
There might be some dominoes. There might be a chess set.
Somebody is going to come back from the bar with a packet of crisps, and they're going to
leave them
flat on the table.
Pub salad. Pub salad, as Chris Morris always used to call it. You bring back crisps and open it up, so you can share them as pub salad. No, but also, it must be a pork pie with a little bit of mustard. Oh, dear, the eyes are filling up just thinking about it. It's unbelievable.
Also, the prospect of being in a room with people you don't know. I mean, that's fascinating.
It is absolutely gripping. Yeah. Well, I went into town the other day on the tube. And you get on a tube train, there's only like two people in the carriage. And of course, we're all masked, so you can't see all of them. But we're all fascinated with each other.
You've not seen another person, other
than your nearest and dearest, you know, whatever. The novelty of seeing people is quite remarkable, you know. And I walked up Bond Street and Wigmore Street and so forth. And there are lots of construction workers, I think. I think the shop fitting trade's still very, very busy.
Construction trade's doing really well.
They can get on with things, can't they?
No traffic holding up the trucks, bringing the bricks and the cranes and things.
It's great. I was interested to see in London there was one business that still appeared to be thriving. Traffic wardens were still there. You thought, what? There's no traffic. There's nobody parking anything, but they're still there putting tickets on things. Anyway, okay. It all makes work for the working man to do, as I think Flanders and Swan said.
It was Monday morning. Yeah.
The gas man came to call.
The gas tap wouldn't turn. I wasn't getting gas.
Getting gas at all.
They turned the stump up. Oh, yeah. The carpenter runs it. Yeah. The carpenter turned up to put it all to rights. And he nailed right through a cable, and out went all the
and
lights.
Out went all the lights.
It all makes work for the working man. I love that song. Did you say you've been watching films, Jan?
I've been watching films again. Last night I watched The Irishman for the second time.
We never got to the end of that the first time. You'd made the
simple pilot error, Mark, that if you consulted me, I would have told you. No point watching this with your good lady wife or my good lady wife. They're not going to like it.
No, she hasn't.
I'm sorry. And now my wife, I wouldn't even suggest that.
For some reason, she's not up for violence. I don't know why not.
I'm not even sure that I could watch all of it. But anyway, so I watched it again, partly last night and partly this morning. And I kind of quite enjoyed it. No, I tell you what, yesterday, the day before, I watched the film, which I knew pretty much every line of, but I don't think I'd ever sat down and watched it.
Oh, right. Don't tell us what it is. When was it made?
Well, it's a film made in the last 50 years. So it's not Casablanca or something like that. You know, I think it got, when did it come out? I don't know.
American?
No, British. Late 70s, I think, came out. Late 70s, British comedy film. And I'd never actually seen it all the way through. I knew pretty much every line. You know, there was the odd scene where I thought, I've never seen this before. Every other bit I'd seen as a clip. So it was a little bit like, you know, being really familiar with a load of Led Zeppelin songs, but never having listened to Led Zeppelin 4.
Yeah.
From the beginning to the end. Shall I tell you
what? Go on, you'll have to tell us who.
Go on.
It was Monty Python's Life of Brian.
Oh, my God.
I have never watched Life of Brian.
That's amazing.
And shall I tell you the funny thing about Life of Brian? Come close. It's really funny.
It's genuinely really
funny. It's really good.
Oh, I think it's their best.
Oh, yeah. I don't doubt that at all.
Because they've got their very, very simple gags. They're not
such a good gag.
It doesn't depend on the kind of surreal notion of the knights that go knee and all that. Yeah, they're just brilliant gags. My favourite gag is where they go to the stoning. And the Terry Gilliam character and the Terry Jones character, I think, go up to the merchandise stall. And you're meant to be buying stones for the stoning. He says, two rocks, a little bag of gravel. So that's one of the best jokes I've ever heard. The idea that a bag of gravel's not going to kill anybody. It's just an irritant. It's just sort of mean-spirited trick. Michael Palin. Oh, he's fantastic, isn't he?
Oh, they're all wonderful. Well, John Cleese, I mean...
One cross each. First door on the left. That's right. Yeah.
Cleese is the Roman shoulder, a Roman soldier, and as the man from the popular front from Judea or whatever he is.
Yeah.
It's the same character. And he's forever charging onto screen, in a way that's just, it's just funny.
Yeah, it
physically
is.
Funny. Oh, God. Anyway, so I've watched it all in bits over the years, and that was the first time that I've sat and watched it from the beginning to the end.
Isn't there a bit at the end where they're queuing up with their crucifixes, and he says to Eric Idle, they're all queuing up, and they go, one cross each, first on the left or something. And I said, are you crucifixion? Yes, crucifixion, yes. And Eric Idle goes, no, I'm freedom. He said, oh, well done. Oh, congratulations. He said, I'm only joking, crucifixion. So good. Sorry, anyway, what were you saying? Go on.
It struck me, are there any other films or records or anything like that that you're similarly aware of but have never actually watched? That you're really familiar with, but you've never, if you think about it, you've never sat down and watched it. Because there must be.
There must be, mustn't there? Oh, my goodness.
Okay. Well, no, you don't have to come up with an answer right now.
The only thing at a tangent that I was thinking about the other day was there was a piece in Strong Words magazine, the very, very good literary magazine, about Jaws. And they just, Ed Needham just interviewed you for his podcast, David. Oh, that was amazing. Yeah. I remember, I think I read Jaws in 77 when it came out. That was incredible. But Peter Benchley, how his father came from a very well-to-do background. His father paid him $1,000 when he was a teenager to pay him to write 1,000 words every morning. In his holidays, just to see whether he could deal with the isolation and the discipline. Really good idea. Pay him whatever he would have got bussing tables in a restaurant. When he decided he was going to be a writer, he then wrote this idea for the book. And then I didn't realise that right up to the very last moment, they didn't have a title for the book. They had 125 titles, I think. The Jaws of a Leviathan, The Jaws of Death, Leviathan Rising, A Question of Evil, Pisces Redux, Omnivore, The Edge of Gloom, etc. And the only word they could agree on of all of those was Jaws. They just thought, let's call it Jaws.
And
it looked great on the sleeve.
It fits.
And it fits, and the art director would have loved it. That's quite interesting. But no, yeah. I'm going to have to go back and think about some movies I haven't seen. There must be some. God.
Yeah, well,
I don't think this is really embarrassing, actually. I don't think I've ever sat down and listened to both sides of Abbey Road together from start to finish.
Oh, but you've heard the whole thing, though, haven't you?
Heard the whole thing. I've never listened to Dark Side of the Moon.
You've never listened to Dark Side of the Moon?
Nope. I've never listened to Appetite for Destruction.
All right. That's forgivable.
Now, I'm going to issue a challenge, Alex.
Okay.
Between now and next week, this is your homework, you've got to listen to Dark Side of the Moon.
Okay.
Yeah, report back here.
We want to know what you think when you listen to it. Okay.
We used to have a piece of the Word magazine called Like a Virgin, where you did this. It's Andrew Harris' idea. It's very good. You went and listened to something you've never, some really well-known thing that you had no idea what it was about.
Yeah. Actually, you know what?
It was the first time.
As you guys, I think I've told you guys before, I've been poring through the listening suggestions from Dave's book, through that I listened to my first Bob Dylan album.
That's right. Yeah. I know. Which one was it again? Was it the first one?
It was the first one, I think. The first one.
Oh right, not really representative, but yeah.
But yeah,
amazing.
My tiny little mind blown on many occasions. Excursions. First Led Zeppelin album as well, actually.
Good record.
Yeah. I accept the challenge. I look forward to
do that. Do that.
Setting us a challenge. We should be listening to, an Aphex Twin we've never heard. We should be listening to some...
Oh, that's a good idea.
Some slice of rave madness. I don't know, actually, is it? I don't know if I've got the reference points to be able to describe
it. Yourself, mate.
Yeah. I don't know. I think you'll probably end up just resenting me if I just give you the notice. Yeah.
Maybe.
So I've been thinking a lot about Creedence Clearwater Revival and John Fogerty this week, which led me to this conclusion that the best one-man band album ever made, in the sense of one person playing all the instruments, and not just a guy with an acoustic guitar or piano, whatever, but being a band.
Bass, drums, the whole thing, yeah.
Yes, is John Fogerty's The Blue Ridge Rangers, which you made in about 73, 74, or something like that, after Creedence Clearwater Revival. And Dave, he'd already pretty much proved that he could do it all himself, but this time he really was setting out to do it all himself. And it's not a perfect record, but do you know why it's the best one-man band album?
No, go on.
Because he didn't write any of the songs.
Oh, that's interesting.
And most one-man band albums are kind of demos.
Yeah. You
know, they're indulge me. I'm going to do my own thing over here, you know. You know, Paul McCartney's first solo album is Here's Me in My Domestic Bliss and Lovely Linda and All About My Wife and My Child's on the front of it, you know, and it's all homemade, and that's what you should love about it. Whereas Fogerty was setting out to make a really commercial record made up of rhythm and blues covers, country covers, slightly less well-known things, but it sounded like a band absolutely all the way through. So it doesn't sound homemade at all. But it's good because he didn't write any of it.
That's interesting.
Most of those things are not like that. So Paul McCartney, first solo album, it's got Maybe I'm Amazed on it, hasn't it?
Yeah, it has. Yeah, Junk, that would be something.
Okay.
Yeah.
But it's got a lot that's kind of neither in or there, you know. It's got a lot that's only on there because Paul McCartney's in charge and he says what goes on it. You know, and I think that applies to most one-man band records.
They are. I think a lot of those one-man band records, you think of them as being a technical exercise, but if you can count it, Tubular Bells is one, I think. I think Music of My Mind, Stevie Wonder one. I think the Foo Fighters' first album, I think Dave Grohl just made it because he just wanted to get the record
out.
Oh,
God, that's a cracker. The second
one. Yeah, he just did it incredibly fast, and each track took him about 45 minutes to do or whatever. Todd Rundgren, I don't know enough about, actually, to know, because he did make several, I think, just on his own. But a lot of those are technical exercises. Never, by definition, you know that what you're not listening to is a load of people playing at the same time together. But the thing about the McCartney that really knocked me out, I think, was a kind of political statement. You know, they had all the politics and the technology and that collaboration, all the people involved in those recordings at Abbey Road, juxtaposed with this kind of oaky, organic woodshed field. I used to imagine it was just literally an old barn with hay bales, with an AC-30 perched on the top, you know. And that does have a wonderfully kind of warm and human feeling to
flavor.
It. You know, flavor.
No, it does.
Just a four-track recording. And that, it's not a particularly distinguished record because, as you say, there aren't any other, not that many really sensational songs about it. But as a kind of political statement, as saying, I can do this on my own, I don't need the others, I found it very moving at the time. I still think it's amazing. And I even think that the recent one was pretty good. The track on it called Long-Tailed Winter Bird, which is absolutely amazing instrumental on this, on McCartney 3. But I mean, John Fogerty, surely, in a class of his own, isn't he? My God, how many people? There are very few.
Could you count Prince?
Prince, absolutely, he should be in there. Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know how much of his did he do too, on his own. Did he?
I think he did a lot on his own.
Did he? Okay.
Yeah. I didn't realise that until very recently, actually. But when you go back to listen to those records, like Raspberry Beret and all that stuff, with a knowledge that that's Prince.
Yeah.
All of it. You know, it breathes a completely new sense of life into the songs. You know, you listen to them in a different way, for sure.
Yeah.
Is there anything, can you think of an example where somebody has done something on their own, where they played all the instruments, where it sounds better than the same thing done by a load of musicians? Because...
Well, you're talking about the same song.
Yeah. So,
Don't know. There's a famous clip, isn't there, of Jeff Lynne doing Have Mercy, where he plays all four instruments and does all the vocals, and he's a little film of him.
There's always a sort of coldness about something.
Yeah, yeah, there is. There isn't that particularly.
Where somebody has clearly, they've done the drums first, then they've kind of done the bass or whatever, and it's all overlaid, and it always feels like that.
Yeah.
I can't tell whether you're just persuading yourself that it feels like that because you know it's been made like that, or whether it just generally, genuinely sound different.
I don't know, but that was my general feeling about Tubular Bells. I can remember being completely unmoved by it. I mean, it's really good as a technical exercise, but I didn't find anything remotely soulful or moving about it. I don't know if you, I thought it was an incredibly cold clinical experience.
We used to,
19-year-old rather eccentric guy kind of patching together track after track after track, you know.
Could you count Rock the Casbah? Because I can't imagine The Clash ever played that anywhere near as good as it sounded on record. And that was all Topper, wasn't it?
Was it?
Yep, Topper did. He went in and he laid down. I think he got into the studio early one morning and he had this idea and he laid down the bass, he laid down the drums, he laid down that piano riff. I think Mick Jones is playing the guitar on it, but that's basically
it. Oh,
really? But otherwise,
really? I never knew that.
Rock the Casbah is Topper
heading. That's amazing.
And of course, he got booted out. Cheers, lads.
Cheers, thanks for that. So is Joe Strummer not on it then? Does he not appear on it?
Oh, he's singing on it.
Well, he's singing on it.
But, oh, no, sorry, I was thinking it was the one that Mick Jones sings the vocal on. Of course. Yeah, that's Should I Stay or Should I Go?
But it's such a tight production, and Topper was such a brilliant musician. You know, he was far superior to anyone else in that group, you know, in terms of his chops.
Was he? Was he really?
Oh, he was a jazz guy. He knew how to play. I think that was one of the reasons he was hired, because, you know, he was so much better than Terry Chimes was, you know. I mean, if you listen to the first album wasn't Topper, that was Terry Chimes, and then afterwards. But you listen to the progression after that and just what they did musically, and it all starts and ends with Topper's drums. But yeah, that record was
So booted out for showing up the shortcomings of the others, like Glenn Matlock. I always used to love that. Glenn Matlock was supposed to be thrown out, wasn't he? Because he liked melody and he liked McCartney and he had a huge record collection, you know. Where we got to, by the way, in jabs and pop groups. I love that story. Do you remember? We were at Ultravox and the Pet Shop Boys and had theirs done, hadn't they? Spans and Duran Duran.
All the 60 pluses and all the 50 pluses have had them. So it's we must be heading for the 40 pluses.
It's got to be China Crisis, the haircuts. It must be Johnny Hates Jazz.
Oh, my God. They've got to be done. They must have been done.
Rick Astley, Lisa Stansfield, Sam Fox. Must have been done.
Answer your names. Have you had your jabs? Rick Astley. Yes, sir.
So if Smash Hits were still going, we'd have a cartoon. We'd have a fortnightly cartoon.
Who's had the jabs?
That'd be really good.
I can tell you that Ian Brown hasn't had his jab.
No, clearly not. No, he's still withering on.
He tweeted recently that... He said something like, "I refuse to play any gig in front of an audience that has been forced to vaccinate." And somebody replied, "Isn't that up to Butlins?"
Not making himself any favours, is he?
Not really. So, any other business, boys?
What else?
What is this going on in the world of words? Go on, Alex.
We have some new patrons.
Oh, good.
Go on.
I'm just going to bring them up.
Let's poke them aboard.
Got a handy little list.
And we must plug the merchandise, which Dave and I are sporting. Shouldn't we?
Yes, absolutely.
There it is.
We've got a new merchandise page on the website, actually.
Great.
Right. So if you go to wyelondon.com, there is a tab at the top that says merch.
Merch.
And that's the tab you want if you want
you can get hoodies, you get t-shirts, you get
mugs,
teacups, mugs,
face masks.
Get your mask before it's too late.
I love it. Yeah, hurry, while stocks linger. Yeah,
they'll be out of fashion when COVID's over. You know, you need to be on top of the zeitgeist while it's there.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Wearing them as a fashion statement, it'd be like Morrissey with the hearing aid. Wasn't it?
That's it. Exactly.
Okay, so
have you got new patrons?
We've got three annual patrons this week. If you're an annual patron, of course, you get a 15% discount. They are Robert Few.
Hello, Robert.
What a great name.
Jerry Perkins.
Oh, Jerry Perkins.
Who he?
Yay.
Yeah.
And Warren Saunders.
Warren Saunders. Welcome aboard. We will probably be doing birthday word in your attics with them, weren't we, at some point?
Yep, yep, yep.
We've continued to do those over the last few weeks. They've all been very good. It's been delightful to drop in on people's homes and see what they've got, go through
huge
their stuff.
It's
really nice. And we should be getting back in the swing of word in your attics over the next week or so.
We have a Daryl Bullock crowdcast going up in the next couple of days.
Daryl Bullock has written a book called The Velvet Mafia.
Velvet Mafia?
Which is about the gay men who invented
fantastic
the swinging 60s. And he was a really good guest. And so, yes, that'll be up there. That'll be up there soon. And we should be linking up very soon with the legendary Bob Harris. We put that off for a few days, but we'll try and fix it up.
Yeah, he's got his tour coming back. His tour with Danny is back on again.
His tour with Danny's back on.
Yeah,
brilliant. And the Friday night quiz goes from strength to strength. So if you haven't joined that, never too late to join. That takes place at 6 o'clock. Ideal introduction to the weekend. And anything to add, Alex? Anything further? If you want to know about becoming a Patreon supporter, patreon.com/wordinyourear for further details. Anything more? Any more for any more, gentlemen?
We're there. I think we cracked it. Thanks for listening.
This podcast was brought to you by The Word.